Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'm welcoming you to a conversation with Claudine Gallagher. She is the founder of Post-Mormon Mental Health, and in fact, you'll be able to look her up if you're an ex-Mormon or someone who is deconstructing your Mormon faith, and you're looking for some help, some guidance from someone who's been there, done that, in a sense, got the t-shirt. You can look her up, postmormonmentalhealth.com, or look her up on Facebook, Claudine Gallagher. I will put the links to that in the show notes. This was a really fascinating discussion because not only did we get into Claudine's own story about her own sort of deconversion or deconstruction of her own Mormon beliefs, but what the impact was on her husband, her children, and how that's still an ongoing story. And in fact, it's kind of a funny thing. You can hear Claudine's own sort of life coach, her mental health aspects of what she does with people, primarily, obviously, those coming out of Mormonism. But even in this podcast interview, it kind of turned into a little bit of a mini therapy counseling session. We started getting into this issue of triggering and how I've been triggered by certain things in my past coming out of fundamentalism and fundamentalist Christianity, evangelicalism, and all that, which is my background. And we get into this interesting discussion, and I'm hoping that for you it'll be a helpful thing as you kind of eavesdrop in on our conversation as we talk about these are very common things for people coming out of religion. It's something that Janice Selby said. She's been on the podcast a couple of times. She said that, you know, religion's kind of a double whammy because on the one hand, people suffer religious trauma while they're in the system. There's all kinds of spiritual abuse, sexual abuse, all sorts of things that go on while you're in the system. And then when you decide to leave it, it's another hit because on the back end, as you decide to walk away from the whole thing, there's another hit because, of course, you're going to lose friends and family. You might be shunned. You might lose all that community, all those relationships that you spent so many years or even decades building. And so there's another hit on the back end. So it's a double whammy. And in fact, speaking of Janice Selby, while I'm thinking about it, she is hosting another Divorcing Religion online workshop. That's coming up, I think, on the 22nd of September, starting up again toward the end of this month. If you are a supporter of Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, not only will that help me get my show out there and help me cover my expenses, but it also will get you a discount to Janice's upcoming Divorcing Religion workshop. So if you're interested in hearing more about that, you can get a hold of me. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. I will put you in touch with Janice and give you the information about that workshop that's coming up here at the end of September. I highly recommend it. Everyone who's gone through it that I've talked to has said it's been super helpful dealing with religious trauma. And in fact, some of the things that Claudine and I are going to get into in this episode, these issues of triggering and working through the sort of mental health aspects of coming out of a religion, and in this case, particularly Mormonism. So I don't want to keep you too long because this is a long discussion that I had with Claudine. So I hope you enjoy our talk as we get into this issue of post-Mormon mental health with Claudine Gallagher. I'm joined today by Claudine Gallagher. She is the founder of Post-Mormon Mental Health as well as an ex-Mormon. Isn't that right? That is the name of your organization?
Yeah, Post-Mormon Mental Health.
And you, what is it exactly that it does? We're going to be getting into all of that, I think, as we go on. I'm interested to hear your backstory, though. Were you born into Mormonism or did you enter into it later on in life and then leave? How did it all work out?
Yeah, I was not born into Mormonism. I joined the church when I was 19. My great-grandmother died in my arms when I was 15 years old, and it really sent me on a search to understand death, what happened after we died. And I didn't, well, my parents didn't have any religious philosophy, I guess, when I was growing up.
Right. Pretty secular background.
Yeah, pretty secular. I mean, they believed I knew in God, but they never brought me to church, and we never really talked about it. We didn't have prayer in our home. It just wasn't on my radar. And then when I lost my great-grandmother, and it was so traumatic for me, I really wanted to understand, why am I here? And what's the purpose of life? And will I ever see her again? So about a year after that, there was another incident where a young person in our neighborhood was killed in a gun shooting accident. And he was 14 years old and Mormon. And I ended up going to that funeral. And I was very confused by all of these people who really seemed to believe they knew what happened when somebody died. And I was very, very curious. So when Mormon missionaries knocked on my door a few months later, I had several questions I wanted to ask them and started some dialogue with them.
I can understand. Yeah, going to a funeral, these are places where coming out of my background in evangelical Christianity, going to a funeral or as a former pastor, that was one of the kind of spiritual moments where we could sort of get people. You know, you could say, all right, here's our chance. Yes, we have a grieving family here, especially in a tragic accident like a young person. But on the same token, here's our chance to kind of proselytize. So in that sense, the Mormon church kind of got through to you. And you were already in a vulnerable state, it sounded like, because of the death of was it your great-grandmother that passed away?
Right, yes.
So here you were. How old were you at this point?
I would have been 16.
Right, so still young. So these Mormon missionaries come knocking at your door, and so you've had this sort of background in questioning things, spirituality. Here they come, and you're ready for whatever their message was.
Yeah, exactly. I at least wanted to understand what made these people tick. You know, I really wanted to get it. And I was not one of those golden converts, though. It took me a couple years before I decided to join the church. And I went through several sets of missionaries because many of the things that they were explaining to me didn't make sense.
You mean theologically or what? I was going to ask you, what's a golden convert? Is that someone who becomes a Mormon the first time the missionary knocks at their door? Is that what a golden convert is?
Within the first, pretty quickly.
Quickly, yeah.
Golden convert would, so ready and prepared to hear the message. Right. And, you know, really just all they need to do is be baptized.
You just slot right in.
I was like, I had issues with, and why don't women in the Mormon church have the priesthood? And what do you mean I should pray about something and that a feeling will tell me truth? That was, again, outside of my radar. I didn't ever make decisions that way. And I didn't understand why they thought that a feeling would provide an answer as to whether or not something is true.
And that's the famous burning in the bosom sort of thing.
Exactly.
I can remember, when I was an evangelical, I had many conversations with Mormon missionaries who would come to my door, and I loved debating with them because I was into Christian apologetics.
You know,
we argue for hours, and I always came back to that point that it was, I said it was just completely subjective. How can you base your whole eternal destiny on, like you say, a feeling? And that's what they would always come back to. No matter what the evidence I could show that their beliefs I thought were flawed or faulty, they would say, yes, but I prayed and I have that feeling, the burning in the bosom, so I know it's true.
Right.
And I could never get my head around that. But that didn't, eventually, though, it sounds like it didn't stop you from becoming a good Mormon.
Yeah. So at some point, 18, 19 years old, I was pretty lonely, too. This is also a critical time in life and development. And now I'm out of high school. I had started college, was at the University of Washington, and I was living at home and commuting. So most of the friends that I had previously had, were off at other colleges. And I kept attending some Mormon events, and the people were just amazing. And I could see that many of the principles by which they lived their lives were very life-affirming and good. And even though I didn't know in the way that they did that the church was true, you know, I decided that I would give it a try, really. That I wanted spirituality in my life. And I wanted friends who weren't into the drinking and party scene. And the Mormon church is a great place to find those people, you know, that can have a lot of fun without drinking and drugs. And yes, so
they're not going to be drinking, you know, that's for sure.
Exactly. So I joined, and I not too much longer, I went down to BYU, which is Brigham Young University.
Brigham Young University.
The big LDS academic institution.
So you switched from the, you were saying you were going to the University of Washington. Did you grow up in the Seattle area, or whereabouts did you grow up?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Seattle, that's interesting. That's where I grew up too. So we have we have an interesting connection there. I grew up in East Hill, Kent area. So that's where I grew up, just south of Seattle.
I was on the northeast side of Seattle, Bothell, Kirkland.
Oh yeah. Yep. I know it well. So you grew up there. Now then you transferred to BYU. What did you study at BYU, and what led you to go to this Mormon institution?
Yeah, so really wanting that college experience away from home, I applied there and they gave me a scholarship. So I just needed to pay for housing, and the housing in Utah was very inexpensive. So it was affordable. And I wanted an adventure and wanted to meet, like I said, more friends, meet more people my age and learn more about the church. So I went down there. I studied English, and that's what I got my degree in. And then stayed, got married, stayed, got my master's degree in English as well.
So you married a Mormon boy, it sounds like.
I did, yes.
Would you have been allowed to marry a non-Mormon, just out of curiosity?
It would have. The church would have very much discouraged it.
Right.
There are people that do, but they really encourage you to marry within the faith, and also to get married in the temple. And to do that, both of you would have to be Mormon.
I can imagine it'd be very difficult. I mean, we have the same thing in evangelical Christianity. Yeah, it's there are people, obviously, who are one spouse isn't a Christian, the other one is, and that can lead to a lot of problems down the road, for sure, especially when you start having kids. You know, one parent wants to raise them within their particular faith, the other one might not. I can see all the problems coming down the pipeline. But you're a good Mormon couple now. What happened after you get married? Are you settling into the church at this point?
Actually, getting married was a bit traumatic for me because my parents weren't able to attend the temple wedding.
Oh,
and
I see.
It has recently changed, this particular policy. But until very, very recently, if you were to get married civilly, you could not then go and be sealed in the temple. So Mormons believe that in the temple is where they have the authority to marry you for time and all eternity. So it's what makes the forever family. And so I was put in this very, very difficult position, marrying someone whose whole family is Mormon and has strong Mormon identity. And it really wasn't an option for him in his mind to do anything different than get married in the temple. And I definitely wanted to marry this man. Still one of the best decisions of my life. I have no regrets about the human I married, but the place we got married made it really hard, you know, because I can still remember my mom turning to me and saying, Claudine, if The church is for families. Why are they separating us on the most important day of your life? And what do you say to that? You know, I didn't know either. I didn't want to be separated from her. I wanted her to be there. I didn't understand why we couldn't have a ceremony on the temple lawn and then just go up and do the sealing thing right after, but have the wedding part. You know, that's all my parents cared about, was that, you know, moment where I was legally wed.
They just wanted to be a part of it. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, my daughter just recently got married, and obviously we wouldn't want to miss that. It's a huge event.
Huge.
You want to be there, especially as the parent. This is our first daughter that's gotten married. And so for theological reasons and all this, they're not allowed into the temple. It's hard to get your head around. Yeah, it seems like an irony, isn't it? There's got to be some cognitive dissonance there.
Right. Going, right.
Why Mormonism portrays itself, as you say, as being so pro-family. Then why can't your non-Mormon family be a part of this hugely important event?
Yes, and I'm an only child. So, I mean, talk about pressure.
Yeah, there won't be other weddings after this. No more siblings, no more children.
Only chance for my parents to see their child, you know, and that I struggled for a few years really after that. Like every Sunday I found myself depressed. I could not reconcile this in my own brain, even that I had done this thing that wasn't in alignment with my values.
It's very hurtful, obviously.
It was in alignment, like I did want to marry this man. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the whole thing was just too confusing. I didn't have anyone to help me sort through it. And I found myself depressed quite often and not always attending church. It took some time, really, to begin to heal and make some more friends and start going again and beginning to feel a little bit more comfortable. But eventually I did. Eventually, we moved back to the Seattle area. I had three children, two boys and a girl. And somewhere along the line, I did become converted.
Meaning what? Converted what?
Meaning that I understood the church had problems and issues. Like, I couldn't make sense out of all things. But at some level, I did feel like God was leading the organization and that the leaders were, of course, imperfect humans, but that if God wanted to give direction to us, it would come through these particular leaders.
I see. So you became a true believer, really, then. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
You sold out. Despite your misgivings and, well, cognitive dissonance, again, it sounds like you've got these, how did you reconcile that? I mean, I'm curious, with your parents, did you ever make up in terms of coming to some sort of understanding around the wedding thing and some of the other beliefs that you had?
I didn't reconcile it, no. I guess I understood it intellectually. Eventually, the reasons why, you know, the church.
Yeah, they're drawing a hard line.
The policies, right? I mean, they would basically say, and that there are certain obligations that people take on in the temple, and that someone needs to be ready, you know, to do that. And to go in, you need to have a temple recommend, meaning you're living particular standards. It's this very, very holy place. And that it's not fair to people to have them held responsible for things they're not ready for. You know, that would be probably...
That's their line of reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they think of it as sacred, not secret, but sacred, that everyone, that God wants everyone to go there, but at the right time in their lives.
Right, so at some point you become a true convert despite your misgivings, despite the cognitive dissonance. What happens at this point? You're totally sold out, it sounded like.
Yeah, well, totally sold out. I did believe in the goodness of the organization. And there were some things I disagreed with, but I still did see tremendous value in the organization, and had spiritual experiences that led me to believe that, yeah, maybe this is God's church. And, you know, Mormonism is very organized. So it's organized kind of like school districts are, at least here in the U.S., where, you know, you land someplace and you're assigned based on geography, you know, a school. But in Mormonism, it would be a ward, and then many wards make up a stake. So that would be like a school district. And so you can basically go anywhere, know in advance which ward building you'll go to, who those people are in that community. Talk to them ahead of time. People will help you move. There's always people there that will have your back if, you know, something should go wrong and a member of your family ends up in the hospital, meals are brought in. You know, people take care of each other really well in Mormonism. The community is special.
So there's a strong sense of community and connectedness. Because, I mean, I can only relate it to my example of, as a Christian in our faith, if we moved cities, let's say we moved from Seattle down to Portland, we had to find a church. You know, you had to go church shopping, and there was none of what you just described. We weren't plugged in but to anything. We had to start all over from scratch. Exactly. And so we had to form a new tribe, and it took several years, and it was a real struggle. And, you know, I can imagine there's that sense of security and community. It's already built into the system. So right. that seems like a real positive.
My brain said, if God was going to have a church, and there is one true church, God would have it organized. Right?
So
these are the types of things that, you know, led me to believe little by little, and then seeing the benefits of that, and the, you know, tremendous feelings of safety. Also, it's not just people there to have your back, but it's this instant community that you can also serve. So, you know, who will accept your service?
Yeah. So they're just, yeah, you're just as much a part of it as you're giving, but also receiving as well. So yeah, I can understand that. It's a huge part of community, why people stay in particular religions for as long as they do. I think it's why we stayed at our last church as long as we did, because we had serious problems with some of the stuff that was going on at the leadership level, but we loved a lot of the people. We had formed significant relationships with them, and it's difficult to walk away. It's very difficult to walk away from that. Really hard. You know, people that we love and people that we had over to our house, and we stayed the night at their house and, you know, had meals together and helped each other out, like you say. So that's a huge bond, and you could risk losing all that if you should leave.
Yeah, so it's very difficult. You feel like there's at least certain elements you know about the other human if they are part of your religion. You believe that they're going to live, like in Mormonism, by certain standards, right? They're not going to be alcoholics.
Yeah, certain values. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're becoming a staunch Mormon at this point. So you're back in the Seattle area. You got plugged into another church. Well, it's a ward, right? In the Seattle area.
Yeah.
So what happens after this?
We did a little bit of moving around in the Seattle area, but eventually my husband changed jobs and we moved to California. And my oldest son at this point stayed and in the Seattle area and was living with my parents and going to a community college there. And we came down to California again, had a great ward to land in, met lots of people. Things seemed to be going really well. But my oldest son began to show signs of depression. And at one point he reached out to me and I knew something was really wrong. And my mom indicated that he was sleeping like 20 hours a day. And that was very
really
concerning,
struggling.
Very scary.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
what's
very
going
concerning.
On? What is going on? So, I asked my mom to take him into the doctor, but also sent my husband up to the area to go get him, bring him back to California. And so we could get him some treatment. I knew he wasn't in a place he could take care of himself. And so we brought him down, and it took a while. It turns out he was very low in vitamin D, and he, you know, we did all kinds of labs, got him some antidepressants. It took several months to get for him to get to the point where he started to open up even just a little. But during this time, I could tell whenever I brought up anything to do with the church, he shut down. And I could tell by the look in his eyes that something traumatic had happened. You know, I was really scared. I was starting to worry, you know, was he assaulted? Like, really, what happened to this kid? And so during this process, my second son put his papers in and decided to go on a mission. And he goes on his mission. And right around then is when the oldest son starts opening up a little bit more. And of course, I'm very concerned and worried, but I really want to have understanding. And I end up starting to do my research, doing some more research, because he had all these questions. And I was so sure there would be answers to the questions that he had. And I knew some of the issues he had talked about and had worked my way through mentally, you know, apologetic stuff that I could make sense of, you know, enough of it that I didn't think it would throw me for a loop, but it actually did. It turns out he had read some information about the church. The reason he had shut down is that when he read this, he lost his faith. And he did not feel like he could tell us, and he didn't feel like he could not tell us. So, because he couldn't handle it alone, he believed that if he told us, the only options he could foresee are that we either reject him and stay in the church and not believe him, or we lose our faith, go through all the pain he's been in, and he would be at fault. It would be his, you know, it would have been him who was the cause.
So it's a lose-lose.
Right?
So, yeah, lose-lose no matter which way he goes about it. He's kind of painted himself into a corner, it sounded like, right? Where there's no good way out. So, yeah, he's clearly struggling then.
Struggling. So he's just, like, swirling in these different thoughts and cannot resolve it, and so he shut down. And so it was me creating some safety, really telling him, now listen, I want you to share with me anything that you want to about your feelings about the church, even if they're negative. I'd rather have us talk about it than you to have to do this on your own. And I really wanted him to heal. Of course, I wanted him at that time also to come back to the church. And it wasn't until I really let go of that desire that he felt safe and really began opening up. And then I did research. And what happened to me was that what I found was not what I expected.
You expected to find all the answers.
Exactly. And what I discovered was, you know, not only was the church not true, but it wasn't truthful. And this organization that had been asking me year after year, you know, for Temple Recommend interviews, if I was honest in all my dealings with my fellow men, were holding back significant pieces of information. They were not disclosing some things that were provable based on evidence that were not faith promoting and really hit the very core truth claims of the LDS Church.
So can you give us some examples of what you uncovered in terms of these easily, well, disprovable things, it sounds like, but they're promoting it as provable and factual and it's all part of our history and true, and it's everything else.
Yeah. So one of the pieces of Mormonism or stories I connected with was the story of Joseph Smith. And the story the missionaries told me was Joseph Smith at age 14 didn't know which church was true, right? And so he read in the Bible, you know, if any of you lack wisdom, ask of God and it will be given to you. So he goes to this grove, he prays, God the Father and his son Jesus Christ appear. They tell him none of the churches are true. And basically, this is the point in which he realizes he's going to have a special work to do and which will be given to him later, right? This is an event that changed the history of the world, right? Is how it was presented. And the way the story's written up in the scriptures, you know, I would call it, this is, was a version written down in 1838. It was not in Joseph Smith's handwriting, but it was his account at that time. And the way it is put together, it's, you know, it's not just a good story. It's a damn good story. It's got
a great
all
story.
Of these amazing elements of, you know, he goes to pray and then there's this opposition. And, you know, his body basically seizes up and darkness comes in. And, you know, the things that all of us really go through in life when, you know, something good is going to happen and obstacles get in the way, right? And then the light opens and
revelation.
This young boy, and it's amazing. It's this beautiful story, both in the plot, but also in the way it's told, the language in which it's told. And of course, I was a teenager when I joined the church. This story resonated with me very much. If there was answers out there, I wanted to know them. And how would I ever figure out which of any of these churches is true, if any of them are, right?
And so God wants to help you out.
Yep.
Yeah. He's giving you the answers.
Said that particular story was written, or account of the first vision was written down in 1838. And it's put in the LDS scriptures. And what I discovered was that there was an 1832 account. Actually, there were several accounts of the first vision, but the one that's the most problematic in my point of view is the 1832 account, because it's actually written down in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And it is the earliest account, so closest to the actual event. So one would think this particular account would have more, you know, authenticity value. It's more likely to be accurate. Yes, exactly.
Historically verifiable and all that.
Exactly, right? So when you read that account, only one personage appears to Joseph, not two. This is a really, really big deal in Mormonism. Huge.
Yeah, it's pretty huge.
Okay, but even bigger for me was to read Joseph Smith write that by reading the scriptures, he had determined that none of the churches were true. And when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh. He never asked the question. We're talking the founding question of Mormonism. Once, if you would already decide something, he didn't go to ask God. In fact, what he did go to ask God on that day was, it was a prayer for personal forgiveness. This wasn't anything about the world. This was a young man who wanted to know if his sins had been forgiven. And his story is similar to the story that many people had at that particular time. There were lots of people who prayed for personal forgiveness and even had visitations from what they believed was Jesus.
Right, so it was a common experience.
Exactly. It wasn't unusual. And it floored me. I knew I would find, or that I could find, some challenging things to work through, but I had no idea something that big and that devastating Well, because the church is, well, because so many people are finding out certain things, the church wants to be the source that people find when they Google any of these controversial issues, right? So they publish these essays, which they call gospel topic essays, but these are on the church website. And there's several different controversial issues that they address. The first vision accounts is one of these topics. So I read the essay. I went, read the 1832 account, came back and reread the essay. And it doesn't go into any details about the ways that these accounts are different. And in fact, it said in the church essay that the accounts were consistent.
Which they aren't.
I remember this was a moment actually of trauma for me. I'm like, it says consistent. Like this phrase was like going through my brain
over and over again.
It says consistent. Does it say that?
Not like, right here.
Can they really be saying that after I just read? Like, and I get it, of course. If a story is told a variety of times, sometimes one detail may be included, another time it may be forgotten, right?
Get like, embellished, yeah.
Yeah, so I get it that no story, it has to be exact. So, but for them to say that the 1832 account and the 1838 account are consistent when they are different in the very details the church has long said matter the most, which is the purpose of Joseph's prayer and what happened after, how many personages, you know, what appeared and how
Pretty
many
important
and God showing right. up, right? Like for them to say that they're the same was like my trust in the church as an organization. For them to use that phrase when so clearly they wanted people to not actually go read the account. All the old women to go, and the church, you know, I believe the church. They say it's consistent. It's not a big deal. They say it's not a big deal. Therefore, it's not a big deal. And I was just so blown away.
So it's really shaking your faith. To read these different accounts and have this, now all these cognitive dissonance is coming back again.
Yeah.
So what did you end up getting out on the back of that? Because it sounds you're trying to help your son.
My son is coming to me looking for help. I'm the one doing all the research. At that point, I go and I say to my husband, look, I cannot do this alone. what I am finding is not what I'm expecting. And I'm very confused. So he, because of his family circumstances and, you know, that Mormonism is so much a part of his identity, but he's very, very logical. He had for many, many years just put up blinders, like knowing, you know, I can't do this. This would, you know, really hurt my mom. And I need to be the strong one. So the way to do that is really probably not look at a variety of things.
Just ignore it all.
So he read the essays, those gospel topic essays. For him, the controversial issue that just dropped everything for him was on the method of translation for the Book of Mormon. And, you know, Mormons are taught that Joseph translated from gold plates that were given to him, and that he used a special instrument that God gave him to do the translation. That this wasn't like a magical thing. This was like actual work where there's characters here. God is helping Joseph to determine what those characters say, and that's how the Book of Mormon came to pass. Well, it turns out that the historical evidence shows that Joseph Smith used a rock, a seer stone, that that he had found down in a well that he had used for treasure digging, right? Not a special instrument. This is like the commonplace, really, swapped for the sacred, put in a hat, and that the plates were nowhere around him. He just put the stone in the hat and channeled, basically. Of course, the essay doesn't say that, but that's basically what it was, right? He channeled the Book of Mormon. My husband had served a mission when he was a young man. He remembers people approaching him, talking to him about the seer stone and the hat, and him saying to them, no, you know, I don't know where you heard that, but that's not true.
Can't be true.
Right? It can't be true. If it was, my church would tell me that, right? This is actually how it happened. And, you know, so for him, the moment he read that, he had actually had spiritual experiences connected to this idea of Joseph translating. You know, he didn't believe in magic. And so when he read that, something just shifted very quickly inside him. In fact, almost scary quickly to me, you know, given his background and his identity, but it was similar as a, my shift with the first vision. It mattered to me. And
he snapped basically, yeah, in the reverse direction. Yeah,
like, I don't believe in magic. I don't believe that this could have come from God this way, that this is how God would work. And on top of that, clearly the church lied and has covered it up. So it's a combination of both, you know, the information, but also the clear recognition of information that has been not just hidden, but in this case, you know, presented in a very, very different way.
Well, this might lead into another kind of discussion. Would you consider Mormonism a cult? Because I know we haven't gotten to the point where you've eventually gotten out, but it sounds like you're deconstructing as well as your husband, being faced with these kind of stark realities and going, whoa, I'm questioning everything now.
Right.
Is it a cult? Because one of the hallmarks of cults is, of course, they use deception to mm-hmm. hide what they truly believe from recruits. And only right. when you get further and further into the actual religion, you slowly begin to find out more and more about what they really believe. And of course, Mormons believe a lot of really bizarre stuff about inheriting mm-hmm. their own planet and populating it and being eternally pregnant and star Kolob and on and on and on. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But I've never heard a missionary come to my door and tell me about Kolob or any of those other things on day one.
Right. Exactly. No, it has many, many of the identifying markers of a cult. Yes. If you look at the Bite model, absolutely. Mormonism in one way or another fits most of that criteria.
Right. So we're talking behavior control, information control, thought control, emotional control. They're mm-hmm. trying to control you. And that exactly fits, as you say, the hallmarks of a cult.
Yes.
It's a pyramid shaped structure, isn't it? Ultimately, you've got a group of men at the top, isn't that? And you've got a president
Correct.
Who's at the very top of that.
Correct.
Worldwide structure. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it all flows down from this pyramidal shape.
Right. So the president of the church is, you know, called the prophet. He is, you know, according to Mormon beliefs, the prophet on the earth today. So with that mindset, you know, what he says comes from God. And
similar
there
to the
is
Pope.
No,
yeah.
Even more, though.
Yeah. I mean, speaking mm-hmm. the very mouthpiece of God in that similar kind of way, huh?
Mm-hmm.
This one man at the very top of the organization, when he speaks, that is the mouthpiece, the word of God.
Right.
Yeah, so that's a scary kind of cultic construct there. And then how does it flow downhill from that? You've got all these stakes and wards, and as you say, is looking at it now that you've left the church, what's your assessment of the way the organization actually runs in terms of the day-to-day management of the followers?
Right, well, it's completely run by men. It's patriarchal.
Yeah, it's totally patriarchal. There's no women in charge of anything.
Well, there are women in charge of some things. However, women are never in charge of men, not adult men.
Right. So they can teach children or other women. Children
and other women. And there are, in those spheres, quite a few leadership opportunities for women. Everyone in Mormonism is a teacher, a student, a public speaker. Women can teach men Sunday school in a class, but there's still a Sunday school president who will be male, who presides over that auxiliary, I guess, organization. So, but in Mormonism, there's always somebody with authority over you. You know, the stewardship in which, and you sustain these leaders, and you are repeatedly taught, both directly and indirectly, that, you know, sustaining them is your commitment.
And it's going to be a man. There's no way it's ever going to be a woman. And women can't be priests. Isn't that right? They'll never be. They can never enter into the priesthood like a man can in Mormonism. Isn't that true as well?
Right. They don't hold offices of the priesthood, is how the church would, you know, say. So that, you know, they're not bishops, they're not stake presidents, you know, they're not any kind of general authority. They really, you know, it's when anything comes through the pulpit or over the pulpit, with authority, it's coming from a man or the voice of a man.
Right. So all this deconstruction, how did you end up getting out? You're questioning everything. Now your husband's starting to question everything.
Yeah.
What was the final straw that sort of broke the camel's back?
Well, for us, those gospel topic essays opened that door for us to dig deeper. And I started doing even more reading and, you know, definitely polygamy was the way Joseph Smith practiced polygamy was probably sealed it.
Sealed the deal.
Yeah, but I still would have probably kept attending without believing, at least for a while, because I love the people and I love the service opportunities there. I love the community. However, I now knew a lot of things that other people didn't, that weren't in the correlated narrative, Sunday school, right? And because these essays were put out on the church website, but they were put in a place you wouldn't really stumble across them if you weren't Google searching or somebody didn't tell you they were there.
Not on the main page.
Right. What's end up happening is there's, you know, Mormons aren't on the same page with each other anymore, even about what the church's stance is. And the leaders didn't ever say, you know, well, we used to teach this or we used to present it this way. You know, we were in error. We made some mistakes. Now we're correcting those and teaching this way, right? It was gaslighting. In that, you know, it's like you've been in this room that has been painted orange for 25 years. You walk in one day and it's painted blue. You can handle it if you can say, huh, it's now blue today. But it was like you walk in and everyone around you is like, and it's always been blue.
Yeah.
Is
or
the
it's
message
still orange?
The church is changing history. I really felt like I was in George Orwell's 1984 novel for a little bit. Like,
denying
what's happening?
Reality.
Like, you're just shifting history and then presenting it as if that's the way it's always been. And it certainly isn't. People can't keep their sanity with that. And so I could not go to Sunday school anymore because I realized people are going to say things that are in alignment with this old narrative, and I'm going to not feel okay about not speaking up.
You have to say something.
You know, because that I would not feel good about staying silent. I just wouldn't. I also didn't want to be the one to speak. And I also knew I don't have the authority here. And, you know, I just felt like I was in a catch-22 type situation.
Very tough situation.
Yeah. And so we really just stopped attending fairly quickly. And, you know, at this point, our second son was on a mission. And that was probably the biggest challenge is, oh, my gosh, and now what?
What do we do now? Yeah, he's totally into it. He's on a mission.
Exactly.
What are you going to do?
So I pondered it. There were times I wanted to just get on a plane and go up there and say, and look what we found out.
you're believing a lie. It's all not. It's all lies.
Lies, right? And
yeah,
my husband didn't necessarily think that was the best plan. And I didn't want to. He was 18. Our son was 18. I did not want to just show up, take over, tell him what to do. If he in fact did want to do this, I wanted him to be able to make his own choices, really.
He has to own it, ultimately.
Exactly, right? And so what we did end up doing was being absolutely honest about ourselves, where we were, that we had stopped attending. We told him in very general terms why, without, you know, going through and this detail and this specifics, detail, right? Yeah. Just all dumping it all on him.
You didn't give him the 1832 letter, I guess. Not at that point.
Right. although we did, you know, he could read those essays. So sure. We did say there, you know,
a little bit of research.
They were there. And so basically, I just made a determination I was going to be honest. And I told him I would answer any questions he had. And I also suggested that some of these conversations would be very difficult to have via email. And that if he wants to continue serving a mission, it may not be the best time for him to ask. So we didn't, when he's on a mission, we only were able to talk to him 4 times in 2 years via video chat. So Christmas and Mother's Day.
So he was very isolated from the family in a way.
Yeah, totally isolated. And so this, you know, the types of discussions we wanted to have, we knew, like, it was hard enough on us. You know, you can't have this in an hour.
That's a huge topic. You know,
these are huge, and it takes time to, you know, process and work your way through. And so we just put it in his court and made sure that he, in fact, did want to be there, that this is what he wanted to do. We knew, you know, at minimum, he would be thinking about some things. Because he knows us. He knows we would not have left for trivial reasons. We weren't, you know, it's not like someone offended us and we stopped
you
going.
Just got upset.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, you really deconstructed your beliefs. But yeah, that's the question. How much do you share with him? So did he end up serving his whole, was it 2-year mission? Is it normally a 2-year? So he served his whole time, his whole term.
Yes. Got back a year ago. Mm. And he is at BYU. The rest of that particular story for right now, I'm just going to put on hold, and because that one's really his to tell, and there are some challenges for him to do that right now.
The story's still being written.
That's right. Exactly.
So you got out, but he's kind of still in it. But right. What are you doing nowadays? You have this organization. Are you actively trying to help people within the LDS Church get out, or what exactly do you do with your organization?
Yeah, no, I am just here for people who have chosen to leave, who have gone through their own faith crisis. Many people in the LDS Church are having a similar experience to what my husband and I had, recognizing that the narrative they were taught to believe is not accurate. Also, that the organization has not been fully honest or open. They are not the trustworthy source, I guess, that we thought they were.
And yet they're supposed to be representing the voice of God. It's the one true church.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people also are leaving the church because of the church's policies with regard to sexual orientation and gender and having family members or friends that don't fit in the box that the church wants them to fit in. And so that's another big reason. Also women's issues. There's some big shifts happening right now and culturally in our society, and the church isn't responding.
They're totally out of step.
Many of them. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just read an article. I don't know if you came across this. It was just a few months ago. I think it was the valedictorian of BYU. Mm-hmm. He graduated. Did you see that? And in his speech, he came out as gay.
Yes.
And it was a huge moment, obviously, choosing to do it and so publicly. Obviously, mm-hmm. it was huge.
Yeah.
But also, as a committed Mormon who's graduating with honors from BYU, and the church, the article kind of said that they didn't know what to do. They were like, oh, mm-hmm. my God.
Yeah.
You know, this is a thing. Clearly, there are gay Mormons, but what do we do? But but they said there's been a huge number of gay Mormon teens and kids who have committed suicide because of the stance of the church saying that a gay Mormon cannot go to heaven or cannot enter into eternity and all the rest of it. So it's done a huge amount of damage, literally. I mean, people have killed themselves.
Right, there's no options, you know, that they within the context of the church, if they're going to stay fully active and have a temple recommend, then they have to be alone, really. They're choosing
celibate.
To be alone, exactly. And many can't or don't want to, it's more than that. It's not, you know, gayness is not just sex. It's not about just sex. It's so many other aspects, yet the church teaches, you know, is so behavioral focused in so many ways.
Purity culture type stuff.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And they miss the humanity and the beauty of difference.
But it shows, as you say, the theology of the church is radically out of line with certainly the movements of what's going on today in society. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing in evangelical Christianity around homosexuality and all that, because they don't know what to do. Technically, according to a fairly literal reading of the Bible, people like Paul were against homosexuality. So they don't know what to do if they're going to maintain sort of this literalistic view of the Bible and mm-hmm. take their own doctrine seriously. They have to reject it. A gay person cannot go to heaven in their way of thinking, you know, but the Bible also says God loves everybody, you know, so.
Right. Well, for what Mormons do is they make this distinction. You can be gay, but you just can't act on it.
Yeah, Christians will say the same thing. Mm-hmm. That, you can be celibate. You might have same-sex attraction, but as long as you don't act out on it, as it were, physically, it's okay. It's a battle that you're going to struggle with, but God's going to help you mm-hmm. do it. Well, and then there's the other issue of all the myriad of sexual abuse cases that the church has suppressed, same with Jehovah's Witnesses, same with Southern Baptist. I mean, it's not just limited to Mormonism. I was listening to a podcast the other day, the How To Heretics, and they were talking about this, that they don't know how many, maybe millions, tens of millions of dollars the church has paid out quietly to make a lot of these allegations go away of sexual abuse by Mormon leaders, bishops, and people like that high up in the church, and they've suppressed it and they've denied it and they've blamed the victims, and you know, so that's a huge issue as well.
It's painful for those of us who are used to be believers and to realize like some of the tithing money, the money we've donated, you know, were used to silence victims.
Exactly. And if that's all about keeping a good PR image, public relations, making us look good, we can't admit that this has gone on and is still going on. We're going to hush it up and make it go away. And yet, you know, somehow there is a reckoning that's coming, because I know there's more and more resources online, isn't there? There's podcasts, there's websites, there's all sorts of stuff that people are starting to blow the whistle on. Mm-hmm. All this stuff that's gone on for decades. And that's not even getting into like some of the splinter groups like the FLDS and some of the other really bizarre Mormon cults that are kind of offshoots of the main sort of mother church, isn't it?
Yes, there's quite a few offshoots.
Yeah, because I think people think Mormonism is a monolith, but it's far from a monolith, isn't it? There are many splinter groups. Utah, for example, there's lots of polygamist groups that, because officially the church denounces polygamy, doesn't it? Officially they say, no, it's not a thing, but there's all kinds of splinter groups that practice it.
Yes, there are. There are a lot. And, you know, and whether or not they practice it today is somewhat controversial. I mean, they don't practice it with living people, but, you know, a man can be married, and let's say his wife dies, then he can be sealed to another woman and another woman if that wife dies.
Right, just keep sealing them in.
It's not the same for women, right? So he would essentially, you know, be practicing for eternity if you believed that's what the sealing does, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, the church has, back to the sexual abuse allegations and such, they try to protect their image, and they do this at the expense of its people.
Exactly. And again, the Jehovah's Witnesses have done the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. It seems like, because it's such a patriarchal culture, I don't know why exactly that sort of feeds into it, but it's like, if you have powerful men who know that they can basically do almost anything they want and they're going to be protected and covered, and they have that authority over people, it seems mm-hmm. to breed this culture of sexual abuse. And then you have an organization that, as you say, covers it up and protects mm-hmm. its image and throws the victims under the bus.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking for everyone.
It is heartbreaking. And it's very angering, too, especially for victims who feel like they don't have a voice, you know. So there's a lot of stuff. But like I said, there's a lot of good resources out there. That's what I was going to ask you. How can people get a hold of you if they're listening and they might be deconstructing their Mormon faith? What's the best way to get a hold of you and they can, you know, talk to you about your journey?
Yes, they can always write me, Claudine@ postmormonmentalhealth.com, or they can go to the Post Mormon Mental Health website, and there's a contact page there that they can get a hold of me that way.
So how many people do you help on average, would you say? People that reach out and connect with you, hundreds, thousands, how many people have you helped?
Well, that is an interesting question. I haven't calculated quite in that way. I am on a variety of Facebook groups, and I try to contribute, you know, where I can there and help people that way. I also have my own Facebook page. So that's another way to contact me, through the Post Mormon Mental Health Facebook page or Instagram. And so I try to reach out and help people through that means as well. And then I do one-on-one coaching with clients, and sometimes teach classes. Eventually, I'd like to do some group coaching and work towards that. But really what I do is give very practical support for moving from wherever they are, which is often a place of with anxiety and worries, or sometimes not knowing what they want, not being able to make decisions very easily, a lot of fear of disappointing other people, you know, challenges in navigating their relationship, whatever the main pieces are that they're working on, you know, we talk about and I help them see options that they may not be able to see on their own. Whenever we're afraid or upset, the blood leaves our prefrontal cortex. And, you know, it's very difficult to think and to see all options. And if you've been raised in Mormonism as well, even when you don't believe the doctrine anymore, there's still a lot of other beliefs that stay stuck in your head. I'm sure you've experienced this with Christianity too, right? You know, this idea that
all sorts,
that there is a right way to go about doing something, or there's a right answer here, or, you know, that
it's very black and white thinking, isn't it?
Exactly.
Oftentimes it's a black and white dichotomy sort of thinking. As you say, sacred and secular, good and evil, right and wrong.
Right.
All of life gets broken down into those two categories, and God is going to approve of something, and he's going to disapprove of something else. And someone else has been telling me all my life that's right and this is wrong. And so, yeah, it's really hard to start thinking outside that box, isn't it? No matter what
and especially
background you come
if you
from.
Still believe some of the interpretation for emotions that the church gave you, because, you know, in Mormonism, good feelings come from God, and or they're a sign something's true or you're on the right track. Negative feelings, you know, could be a sign of Satan. They could be a sign you're on the wrong track. Contention is bad, you know. Negative feelings should not be experienced, really, because Mormons believe you should always have God's spirit with you. That's kind of the emotion you're always supposed to have, which is this, you know, peace and calm. And so there's a lot of fear, really, about facing both positive and negative, intense emotions, you know. Passion isn't good. Neither is, you know, the anger and the fear and all of these other emotions. So they come out, and of course you're going to experience emotions more intensely than ever before. You don't have the church to go to as a buffer. You can't hand all your problems over to God in the same way you did. And
you don't have the community support either.
You don't have the community support, right? You're on your own, and you're trying to figure out what you believe, what parts of you want to, if you want to keep any of this anymore,
if you want to throw it all out, right?
So it's just such a huge shift. I call it a realiquake.
That's a good term for it.
It's, you know, the reality earthquake comes, and then there's all these aftershocks, and the aftershocks just keep coming and coming.
And get triggered by things. Yeah,
exactly. So I help people figure out how to not be triggered or how to work with those triggers and even make them useful for them.
It sounds like you're doing a lot of good work. I mean, one thing that's helped me tremendously by studying the psychology of cults and how they kind of operate from a psychological point of view, a behavioral point of view, as I look at, I'm coming out of Christianity, that's what's helped me, is to understand how I was conditioned, how I was controlled, how I was manipulated and lied to and things. And I'm seeing then the religious trauma and things like that in my life. And that's what kind of helps me to process through it, talking to people like you, talking to people like, you know, so many people, Daryl Ray from the Recovering from Religion Foundation on a recent podcast, you know, people like that, they actually have organizations to help people recover from religion. It's such an ironic thing. The very thing that promised us peace and enlightenment and freedom and forgiveness and all these wonderful things ended up giving us abuse and trauma and phobias and fears and all sorts of stuff. It's such an irony. So I'm glad there's people like you out there.
Once you get through the deconstruction, you know, it's the reconstruction part that's
exactly
can be extraordinarily challenging.
But you've got to.
So tell me where you're at now. Do you find you have triggers?
Yeah, and that's the thing about triggers is that, of course, so much of the time when you're triggered, you're not expecting it. You could hear a song. You could hear someone say something. You could see something on TV or hear something on the radio, and bam, all of a sudden here's this rush of emotions or whatever it is. And then you've got to go, what was that about? And I've got to now go through and process what just happened. Why am I being triggered? What's that about? You know, a lot of it is for me, you know, like hearing a worship song. I get in the car when I'm in the States, you know, and I hear Christian radio comes on my mother-in-law's got it on her car stereo, you know, it's like, oh, I used to sing those songs in church, and now I don't believe what the theology is behind it. And to hear these people so devotedly, so passionately singing these wonderful songs, you know, you think, God, that used to be me, you know? So it's learning to recognize those and not letting them just blow you out of the water, I think is a big thing.
What's the part that blows you out of the water, though, when you think that used to be me? What are you making that mean?
Well, I guess for me, what I guess is that I used to believe it all. I was a pastor. I was a teacher at a Bible college. I spent over 20 years either in ministry or in academics. I mean, I was really, really into it, you know, and I just believed it. I thought it was all true. I was a passionate believer. I tried to make it work. You know, so I see myself struggling in those times, and I think, God, how could I have been so stupid? How could I have been so gullible to be in that position now that I'm looking back on it? And I have a lot of problems with the God of the evangelicalism, you know, and I think, geez, how do people believe the theology that's in those hymns and songs and everything else? So, and you want to say something about it, but of course, it's the wrong time. You can't say it in the middle of a church service or to a family member who's really believes it.
Yeah. So you're judging yourself then in those moments in part.
That's part of it. Yeah. And like I said, being surprised, I didn't think something like that would be so triggering. And it's like being blindsided. You know, you're just suddenly hit with this emotion and you're going, whoa, it's just a song, but there's so much, because that was a huge part of my life. And part of it is, as you say, I'm judging myself because I spent tens of thousands of dollars. I spent years and years and years of my life studying and being in ministry, and I devoted my whole adult life to it. And now I'm like, what the hell was I doing? I could have been doing a lot of other things with my life.
Right. You know? So that's regret, really.
Yeah.
Right?
There's loss, regret, there's grief. And when I left the church and left all that, I've lost friends, I've lost family members, you know, so like you're saying, the loss of community. It's a huge package, a huge piece of my whole life is just gone. And very, very few people except people who like us who have left something like that understand it. And we understand that loss and the grief and the anger and the need for reconstruction and finding ourselves a new identity and on and on and on.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of stuff.
So one of the things that, you know, I teach and try to help people with is first finding that awareness. So when you're triggered, right, what's happening is you're believing something or thinking something. So where a thought would be like a sentence in your mind, a belief is, you know, something that your brain has just incorporated because you've thought it so many times or you've thought it with strong emotion. So you get a lot of beliefs stuck in there during your time of religion, and you see the whole world through that belief lens, right? Now, cognitively, you don't believe it anymore, but some of those beliefs may still show up, and you're interpreting, you know, your past life in religion now through a new lens.
Yeah.
And makes sense. You know, yeah, and judging it. Right. And that's very normal. There's a part of you that wants to make sure you don't go back there, you know, which is part of the anger that comes up is there to protect you. And so that you remember that that's not the same world or the same lens you want to look at things anymore.
Yeah. And, a new worldview, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot easier said than done, isn't it?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll just say I need a new worldview.
That's a thought in a sense too, right? That's a sentence in your brain that you're believing. And what if you didn't need that right now? You know, what if wherever you are is okay? What if this particular time that you're in, that occasionally you get triggered, is totally fine? What if the triggers, you could look at them and see them as a sign that you are actually changing your worldview?
Yeah, a lot of things have changed and are changing, aren't they?
They are. And as you accept them, so most of us think of the triggers as being a problem and we want them to go away. And we don't want to keep getting blindsided, like we think, and I've been blindsided enough. When will this be over, right?
How long is this going to go on?
Yeah. So what I would suggest, ponder, the idea that accepting whatever is right now for you, even if it is a trigger, right, is an act of self-compassion that's beautiful. And that part of what makes the triggers more intense is this pushing and resisting of them. You know, we end up feeling ashamed or for our triggers, or angry we're still having triggers, or we decide there must be something wrong with us because we're still having triggers. And it's all this additional stuff that we're adding to the experience, which really was, you heard this music, your brain interpreted something about it. You may be aware of what it is, you may not, but, you know, as you think about it now, it's some sort of, and maybe I wasted my life, or I could have been doing something else, right? So that interpretation just sends chemicals down into your body. And the trigger, it seems like it's coming from the music, but it's not. It's actually coming from the way you're perceiving the music, what you're deciding that music means. And when you can just accept the trigger, get curious, like be okay with, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what I was thinking or what I'm believing. You know, I'm noticing this. And then decide, like, how else, you know, in the future when you hear music come on, what is it you want to feel?
Yeah, reprogramming the whole situation in a way, isn't it? I'm not going to let it control me. I want to, you know, say this is how I want to experience this. Well, it was super helpful to talk it through with a lot of people, because that's the whole thing about the experience of being triggered, isn't it? It's when you're blindsided, of course, you're not expecting it.
Exactly,
You know, you're just sitting there and bam, you just get hit. And then you've got to deal with all these emotions all of a sudden that you weren't expecting.
Right.
And then when that happens the next time, you're better prepared to deal with that, aren't you?
Yes, hopefully. Coming up with that. So, but even just for the, like right now, your brain wants to just call it, and I'm blindsided. And that's what it's totally felt like, right? Because it comes. And so if you consider, though, you know, expecting to have these emotions show up sometimes.
It's bound to happen.
Start talking about it as like, oh, because I have a healthy human brain, you know, and I did devote a lot of my time in this other area and I am shifting beliefs, these emotional experiences will show up. And you can pre-decide to think about them in such a way as that they're fascinating, they're interesting, they're part of the human experience, they're part of what makes you human, right? And that's what, even if you can just go there, it's going to feel so much better than what the hell's wrong with me for having these and why. And then if you think, oh, I'm going to get caught off guard, right? Or this caught by surprise, blindsided. I mean, that's going to produce more intense emotions.
Exactly.
Than, you know, I'm going to have these moments where I feel these uncomfortable feelings when presented with things people say or things that remind me of my past Christian experience. Of course I am. I'm a human being.
Bound to happen.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. Maybe that's a good place to end it, because I know a lot of people are going to be triggered, as you say. And I think that's a really helpful discussion to dive into, because you're going to have those experiences, as you say, as you're shifting, it's bound to happen. I think even what you're saying has helped me kind of think it through, being even portraying it as being blindsided, as you say. I'm not prepared for it. I'm not ready for it. You know, right. I mean, I played football for a long time, and I've been blindsided on the field. And, you know, that's not a pleasant experience, because you're not right. You never see the other guy coming. And all of a sudden you're being blown across the field, and it hurts, and you're shocked, and you're angry, and there's all these things because you did not see it coming. But if you could have seen it coming, you could have prepared for it, you know. And that's what I learned. The more I played, I learned to, you know, keep my head on a swivel so I could see these guys coming at me, you know. So yeah, I didn't get blindsided again, you know. Yeah.
So in this case, if you can just expect that you're going to have some emotions like this.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
And then at least they won't come as such a surprise. Like, oh, yeah, I expected I would have this.
Yeah.
And
I'm not you know, devastated by it.
Right. And there's no, and it doesn't mean there's something wrong with me or something has gone wrong. You know, it really does mean you're shifting.
Yeah, view it as a positive. In other words, it's proof positive that you're not in that same place. Because before, I'd have been in there singing right along with everybody else. You know? And I'm, the fact that I'm out in another room having all these emotional triggers and reactions, that's saying a whole lot about where I'm at right now or where I was. This is something that happened to me about a year ago that really it did blindside me at the time. I was not expecting it, you know. So now I can look back on it and process it in a more healthy way and say, yeah, that's a good point. I should expect those things. We should expect them, and don't let them just destroy us in the moment. It's easy to do, though, isn't it?
Yeah. You can think of it as the trigger as being a signal that you might need to deliberately think about how you want to think about whatever triggered you. If that makes sense.
Yeah,
so in this case, The music is a signal that you need to deliberately consider how you want to think about music, or when you hear it and it shows up, what do you want to think about those moments when the music or something else like it reminds you of that? And how do you want to think about your Christian past? You know, deliberately, because you get to tell the story now however you want. And
you set the narrative.
The I wasted my time, or I could have been doing all these other things, probably isn't the most useful way for you to tell, because it'll lead you to feel crappy.
Exactly.
So if you can come up with another narrative, the facts are still the same. You spent your time in these ways, but what else is there that you can still believe, that you can latch onto, such that you are the hero of the story?
Well, and I've seen that for sure, because one of the things that really helped me, I've read a bunch of articles on reconstructing, and one of the guys I came across was an ex-Scientologist, and he talked about you've got to find the things that you can still retain and look for the positives from your time in that religion or the cult or whatever you were a part of. You know, I learned how to think critically. I learned research skills. I learned all these academic things that I wouldn't be the person that I am today without my background, you know, and that happened to be theological studies, but it was still critical thinking. It was still research and writing skills.
Right.
So I took a tremendous amount of benefit from all those years spent in academics and teaching and all that. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. I'm not looking at it as a uniformly negative experience that was all bad. There's a lot of good that I can retain from it. A lot of positives.
And even the things that are quote unquote bad, right? Whatever those experiences, like, really, they can be framed in such a way that there's always more than one way to say it.
You Absolutely.
Know, this is why people who say I'm a victim of abuse have one view of themselves versus those who say I'm a survivor, right? We're not changing the abuse. It did happen. But the way you tell that story is very different. And, you know, here you are, an individual who spent all this time in religion, and now you're showing people that it's possible to change, to do these mind shifts, right? You are the hero of this story. Had you not been there so long, you would have a harder time understanding what that would be like and helping other people in, you know, a similar situation. You have done a very rare and brave thing by being willing to question after all of that time. Like, that's amazing. That trait, the willingness to go, could have I been wrong? Might
could I? Be wrong?
Yeah.
That's pretty huge.
It's a beautiful trait to have that you can now emulate and model and, you know, add value to the world by showing your own willingness.
Yeah. And I see, I see people like yourself, you're doing the same thing, obviously, aren't you, with ex-Mormons as well. Mm-hmm. You could have just turned to become an angry, bitter person and, you know, just become a warped and twisted individual so full of anger. But that's so unhealthy. I mean, I probably was that way for a long time. You know, I was deconstructing and I was angry and whatever. But I see now that the reconstruction piece, that's mm-hmm. hugely important. It is important to deconstruct. But if you stay there, you're just going to be you could become just kind of wallowing in the toxicity of it all and not moving on, not moving past it or through it. Mm-hmm. That's hugely important.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with any of those. The anger and all that. Right. But
it's part of the journey.
It can be tiring. It's exhausting.
Yeah. You can't stay there. Well, you can, but it's so unhealthy.
Yeah. It doesn't help you be who you want to be.
Exactly. And as you say, you're not able to help anybody else. Well, mm-hmm. listen, I don't know what happened there, but we kind of went from your story to now a counseling session for me, but I'm glad that we went into all that stuff about triggers because people listening hopefully will get something out of that and say, yeah, I can identify with what we're talking about. And I think it also shows what you do for people. So I'm glad that we ended up going off on it. It was kind of a tangent, but it was a related tangent.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Claudine. I've really enjoyed this therapy session.
Yes. I have enjoyed talking to you. I am in admiration of all that you're doing. And hope we can talk again.
Yes, definitely. Let's keep in touch. In fact, some of the things I've been thinking about while we're talking, we do a monthly Zoom call for our closed Facebook group for people that are supporters of the show on Patreon. I think it'd be really good if you wouldn't mind dropping in as a guest on the show one of the months for the Zoom call. I think people would really love to meet you, talk to you, some of the people in the group. We're having a one with Conway and Siegelman who wrote Holy Terror. So I'm going to have them on as guests coming up. So I'm always looking for people to drop into that Zoom call. So that might be something we should totally talk about doing.
Yeah, love it. I'd love it. Thank you.
That would
honored.
Be great. Let's definitely talk again. Thank you so much, Claudine.
Thank you. Thanks.
And in fact, not only did I enjoy that chat with Claudine, I got a lot of stuff out of what she said to me about triggering. It really made me go back and think about my own experiences as well as how I've reacted to them. It's really been quite a helpful thing. We are going to have Claudine drop into our monthly Mind Shift podcast Zoom call on the 29th of September. Now, this is for people who are supporters of the podcast on Patreon. They are part of my closed Facebook group. Once a month, we have a monthly Zoom call. And we had last month, for example, we had Conway and Siegelman drop in. And we had an amazing conversation. And as I say, this month, we're going to have Claudine come in and we're going to talk about all sorts of stuff. I'm sure we're going to get into even more of what we were getting into on this podcast, talking about triggering and religious trauma and how to cope with leaving a religion and what to do if you have family members who are still in the religion or the cult, in her case, in the case of Mormonism. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff. And that is one of the great benefits to being a part of the closed Facebook group. And as I say, by being a supporter on Patreon, that's what gets you access to that group. That's one of the benefits, as well as getting early access to episodes that come out on Wednesdays on Patreon in the week that they're going to drop. They normally drop every 2 weeks on a Friday, but you, if you're a supporter on Patreon, get access a couple of days early. If you want to support me, that's great. You can choose whatever level you want, $1 a month, as low as $1 a month, and you can choose whatever level of support you think is
sort of worthwhile if you think my hard work is worth paying me for it. Also, there's something else I wanted to talk about. I've been doing a lot of work on Dominion Theology. Hope you caught my bonus episode linking Dominion Theology to The Family, which is a Netflix documentary that's recently come out in August. I'm going to do another episode, a follow-up to that. There's going to be another bonus episode. I'm doing a tremendous amount of research on this, and I'm going further and further down the rabbit hole. Now, I think what I'm going to do, I've got this interview scheduled with a guy named Frederick Clarkson, who is an expert on Dominion Theology and Reconstructionism, and I think that may actually end up being the second half of this bonus episode. If you don't know what Dominion Theology is, if you don't know what Christian Reconstructionism is, you absolutely need to educate yourself. These are the people, the fundamentalists, who are infiltrating the corridors of power, and they have been for decades now, and there's all sorts of spin-off groups. I've been researching this, like I say, and I'm getting further and further down this thing, and I'm getting more and more concerned as to what they're trying to do, not just in American politics, but worldwide as well, which is really what The Family is all about, and how that links to what is called Dominion Theology. So if you don't know what that is, what you need to do is go back to the episode before this one and listen to the bonus episode on The Family, exploring The Family and Dominion Theology, where I start making those connections. A couple of other things coming up. I'm going to be talking with John Atack. He's an ex-Scientologist. We're going to have a discussion about his own story and how he came out of that cult. I've also got a scheduled interview probably in September or early October with Chris Shelton. I've been on his show a couple times talking about this very issue of how evangelical or fundamental Christianity is infiltrating these sort of corridors of power around the world. And now I'm going to have him on my show. We're actually not going to talk about those issues. We're going to talk specifically about Scientology. Chris is an expert on Scientology as an ex-Scientologist himself. 17 years, I think, he spent in the cult, and he's come out of it. And he does the Sensibly Speaking podcast. If you want to look him up, check out the Sensibly Speaking podcast. There's a lot of information on there about specifically Scientology as well as some other things. But we're going to be getting on there with Chris Shelton. So there's some really cool stuff coming up. Frederick Clarkson, John Atack, Chris Shelton, and who knows what else we're going to get into. But thanks for joining me and Claudine Gallagher. I hope that was a helpful discussion. If you have any thoughts, comments, questions, you can always drop me a DM on Twitter. As I said before, you can follow me at MindShift2018 or look up the MindShift podcast Facebook page. You can find me in a couple different ways there on social media. So let me know your thoughts. Also, if you can, do me a favor, leave me a 5-star rating review on iTunes or Podbean or wherever you find this podcast. That helps with the show's rating. So if you can't afford to support me on Patreon, that's cool. At least leave me a rating or a review. All right, I'll catch you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for dropping in. See you again right here on MindShift Podcast.